I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Doodling on the job can get you into trouble. Unless you're an explorer traversing unknown frontiers, then it's part of your job. Today, how sketchbooks aided the art of discovery and adventure. From Meriwether Lewis to Sir Wally Herbert, find out what the scribblings, drawings, and photos say about the pioneers, pathfinders, and trailblazers who made them. Then hear how Kansas City is celebrating National Poetry Month with its own version of a good old-fashioned throwdown. Poets will be coming from across the country to be here, and we've got an introduction on what you can expect to hear at this weekend's festival. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. They are the first record of new discoveries, in some cases of places never seen before by any human being. They are the sketchbooks of our great explorers, from Meriwether Lewis to David Livingstone to James Cook and Ernest Shackleton. They all left behind first impressions, sometimes in words, at other times in hand-drawn pictures. Notebooks exist for the summit of Everest, the first sight of the South Pole, and the initial views of Victoria Falls. All these have been pulled together in a stunning new book, Explorer's Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure, produced by the husband and wife team of Hugh Lewis Jones and Carrie Herbert. Joining us now is Hugh Lewis Jones. He's an historian and author who travels regularly to the Arctic and Antarctica as a polar guide, and he joins us from England this morning. And Hugh, nice to have you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. It's nice to be with you, speaking down a phone line almost 4,000 miles away.
You sound great, and I appreciate it, Hugh. I want to begin with Wally Herbert. You know, he may not be well known to a lot of our listeners, but he was the leader of the team that made the first crossing of the Antarctic Peninsula, and he happens to be your father-in-law. He was also part of a team that made the first undisputed surface crossing of the North Pole. I'm wondering, was he the inspiration for this book?
He's one of many inspirations, I should say. You know, I'm a historian, but I'm totally biased. I married Sir Wally's daughter, Kari. He's a very well-known figure in England, an explorer who was a supremely talented artist as much as a navigator, made this great journey across the Arctic Ocean in the 60s. But his achievements really have been forgotten. His great expedition passed into the shadow of the moon. And by that, I mean, when he was crossing the Arctic, you know, men were looking skyward into space and men were walking for the first time on the moon. His expedition in the 60s seemed out of step with the times. And one of the motivations of creating a book like this, Explorer Sketchbooks, is the chance to dig more deeply into the lives and stories of some explorers who deserve to be more widely known.
You know, you almost wonder if it was destiny for you guys to do something like this because, as I said, you're a polar guide yourself. Your wife is the daughter of a great explorer. This just seemed to be in the cards?
I guess so. I'm a pretty lucky guy. I mean, that goes without saying. Kara and I met a long time ago. I was curator of a museum in Cambridge, and she was actually writing a book about the pretty amazing wives of polar explorers, and it didn't, I guess, take as long to realize we had lots of shared interests. Her father was a big figure, but I've always been interested in explorers and trying to ask questions of what motivated them to go to the places they went to. My grandfather, in fact, flew helicopters in Antarctica in the 1950s. So, of course, his tales of icebergs and penguins and all sorts of things like that filled my boyhood imaginations.
You know, tell me about a personal highlight in this book for you, Hugh. You know, a set of words or drawings that really grabbed you personally.
Oh, gosh, that's difficult. That's like asking a proud parent which is their favorite child. You know, it's a book of 300 pages, an infinite array of people that we could have written and researched about. There's about 70 or 80 explorers, men and women, from across the ages, from many nations. For me, as a historian, it's always the unexpected things. There are many famous explorers in this book. You mentioned in your piece, Lewis and Clark, David Livingstone, Captain Cook, Shackleton, perhaps names your listeners have heard of. But for me, it was digging deeply in archives and finding rare journals and stories that I knew very little about when I started the process of researching this many, many years ago. I think of one man, a guy called George Lowe. You mentioned Everest. Well, he was on the first ascent of Everest in the 50s, 1953. But he also went as the official photographer on the first crossing of Antarctica, two of the 20th century's great journeys. And I'm able to hold his journals in my hand and look at his original photographs and talk to him before he passed away and hear his stories and hope that his contribution to these great expeditions is more widely known.
I was going to say, for someone like you who has so much interest in all of this, you know, holding a notebook like that in your hands, maybe one that had been to the top of Mount Everest once upon a time, has to be a particular kick for you.
Oh, of course. I mean, if you like this stuff, if you like reading stories of exploration, if you have heroes, perhaps it's Ed Hillary, the first guy to climb Everest, perhaps it's someone else, perhaps your heroes are closer to home. But as a historian, you want to get to the materials, to the archives and to rare materials, perhaps that have never been published or seen before. So yes, spending time with Ed Hillary's private journal, you know, opening it on the day that he's standing, 29th of May, 1953, on the summit of Everest and the whole world falls away beneath his feet. Or having the chance to hold the journal of Captain Scott. There's another polar explorer that maybe some people have heard of. He's probably well known nowadays as the guy who was beaten to the South Pole by the Norwegians, a guy who got there second. But his journal is a very sacred document. He's writing it as he dies in his tent. So his journal holds the secret to his achievements on his expedition. And it's only when that journal is found that all of the information about his sort of epic journey and very tragic death can be understood.
You know, I was going to ask, you know, where did you guys find these things? I mean, you went on a heck of a scavenger hunt to come up with what you did, because you write that you visited obscure libraries, private collections, and dusty attics. Where did you go?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, the process of this book was kind of like an expedition. You said a scavenger hunt. That's a pretty nice way of describing it. A treasure hunt, perhaps. The challenge for me was, I'm a museum curator. I curate exhibitions. But this was the kind of show that you could never really make, because these journals are scattered all over the world. And so, yes, we visited collections and worked in archives, but also worked with families to bring the stories of their ancestors to greater attention. So there's lots of rummaging in big boxes or in attics, or pulling out stuff from under the bed or under the stairs, or trying to uncover things that we really didn't know perhaps existed when we started the book. Some of the things that you could find in this book, Explorer Sketchbooks, are quite well known, but I would wager that there are many things in here that they haven't been seen ever since the explorer themselves wrote these things down in the field. Because explorers' journals and sketchbooks, like diaries, are often very private documents, and they're filled with discoveries and insights and personal information, beautiful images, and what a joy to be able to share some of these things.
I was going to say, how did you even know who to call or where to go to find some of these things that, as you point out, have been out of circulation for so many decades here?
Well, that's why a book like this takes a very long time. I mean, I've been a historian not for so long, for, I guess the best part of 20 years now, but and I've written a whole bunch of books about famous explorers, but it becomes a treasure hunt. But you also passed from hand to hand, through collection to collection. You roughly know where to begin. You have a list of perhaps your favorite explorers or a list of some of the people you might like to feature. But as with everything, and it's true of being a writer or being a historian, is the more you work on a subject, the more you read, actually the less you know, and the more you realize that you need to read. And so it was slightly haphazard, actually, in a way. We'd begin a journey and you'd end up getting distracted up a new river or across another mountain range or in another attic, or speak to someone else and you realize you've got another five people that really ought to be in the book who aren't. And that kind of variety is really why we wanted to make it. So, as you say, we have Lewis and Clark, two very famous American explorers who crossed the continent for the first time in the early 1800s. Mm-hmm. But we also have other very famous American explorers and men and women who did some pretty incredible things. And in the book, you can turn from page to page. We can be in Tutankhamun's tomb with Howard Carter. We can turn a page and be sailing in the Pacific with James Cook, turn a few more and we're sat at the desk with Charles Darwin coming up with his theory of evolution. Turn a few more pages and perhaps we're out in the field again crossing Antarctica. Turn a few more, we're climbing Everest or crashing through a jungle, and so on and so forth.
My guest again, Hugh Lewis Jones. He's the co-author, along with his wife, of a new book, a stunning new book, Explorer's Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. I'm wondering, you know, were there the sketchbooks of certain explorers that you were after that you could never find, Hugh?
I imagine so. I suppose one of the things is, if there's a journal you can't find, maybe it never existed. But certainly there are plenty of examples where the journals of famous explorers have yet to be uncovered. I think of some polar explorers, John Franklin in particular, whose ship, in actual fact, 170 years later, has now been discovered. In the 1840s, he and his men literally sailed off the edge of the chart and were never seen again. It's possible, a faint chance, that some artifacts and journals and manuscripts from that expedition may yet surface. For me, to begin with, I wanted to see and hold Captain Scott's journal, a journal that starts his legend and his story and tells of his time in 1912 trying to find the South Pole. But I was also traveling with other wonderful women. I think of, I don't know, Maria Merian or Margaret Mee or mm-hmm. Alexandra Tinner. These are all intrepid women who perhaps they spent their life searching for a single flower. Or in the case of Alexandrine Tin, she was trying to be the first woman to find the source of the Nile or cross the Sahara. And her sketchbooks are full of wonderful paintings, but she doesn't make it home. She is attacked in the desert and is left to die. So her journals have to survive her. And it's the case with many explorers. That's why they're so important and so immediate, is that within the covers of a journal is the chance for their story to live on.
I'm wondering if, in going through these different stories, if one characteristic above all others emerges, Hugh, and I'm wondering about the whole trait of determination, which strikes me as a theme that runs throughout this book.
I think that's definitely one thing. I mean, what makes an explorer? Well, they're all very determined. I think curiosity is the key theme for me. Almost on every single page of this book, you can see the proof of human curiosity. You know, there's a page with Galileo's first drawings of the surface of the moon. This is in the 1600s. And opposite it, a picture from NASA New Horizons probes in 2015 and the surface of Pluto. You know, without curious minds, across all of the ages, many of these expeditions and explorations would never have begun. Without stubborn individuals willing to prove the doubters wrong, to prove to the naysayers that things they said were impossible could actually be done, without that kind of drive, many of these expeditions would never have even started. Without that kind of curiosity, America would never have been crossed in 1804 and 5 by Lewis and Clark and that great expedition.
You know, it was interesting to me that some of these explorers actually took along with them artists to document their voyages. You know, I'd like to have the work of William Hodges hanging in my living room, Hugh. Tell us about his work, because he used wash and ink, you say in here, to capture the effect of light on the sea, on icebergs, and on the great sailing ships themselves. And he just did an amazing job.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned William Hodges. He was an artist who famously traveled with James Cook into the Pacific, but also farther south, an expedition hoping to cross the Antarctic Circle for the very first time, which they did. You remember, you know, these expeditions, this is in the 18th century, these expeditions, obviously long before film photography and quick and easy means of recording. So, of course, they travel with cartographers, surveyors, people able to both record the natural world but also set down new discoveries on the charts. Someone like William Hodges and, in fact, many other polar explorers, for example, were very able artists. And can you imagine, though, trying to capture an image of an iceberg? I should say William Hodges' paintings in the book are the very first depictions of Antarctic icebergs. Imagine trying to paint when your fingers are freezing, perhaps your paints themselves have frozen, yet your boss is telling you it's really important that these things must be captured. You mentioned in the piece right at the beginning, we talk of pathfinders and trailblazers, men and women doodling on the job. It was actually for many of these explorers to capture the world, glimpses of the world in artworks was a major element of their discovery and life as an explorer. As you and I might travel into the backwoods or go on a journey and take our cameras and take a photograph, many of these explorers are painting in their sketchbooks and describing views in their journals, knowing that without these descriptions, they'll never be able to prove to anyone back at home the wonders that they've seen.
You talked about, you know, the challenges that some of these guys face with the freezing fingers and the freezing paint. Climber Edward Norton faced exactly that, and he ended up sketching so quickly to get down what he wanted to. It would have been so interesting to be sitting beside him, watching him do what he did, because again, under the circumstances, he did just amazing work.
Yeah, okay, so Edward Norton... again, perhaps your listeners don't know his name, but he was a leader of some of the earliest Everest expeditions going into Tibet in the 1920s, when traveling in that landscape was a difficult thing, least let alone trying to climb the world's highest mountain. And someone like Edward Norton, in fact, who has leadership thrust upon him, there's a series of disasters that befall the expedition and he finds himself leader. His lead climber, Mallory, disappears on the face of the mountain, disappears into cloud, climbing high on Everest Ridge. And Edward Norton is kind of left to pick up the pieces. So for him, his journals and his sketchbooks are a means of comfort, but they're also a means of him better describing the story that the world is desperate to hear. Mm. The world, you know, is listening for news of this great Everest attempt in the 1920s. And it's true of all of these explorers. And it's quite amazing, really, whether it was in the 1500s or 50 years ago, there are lots of shared objectives. As I said, the willingness to be curious, but also to set down something of the beauty of the landscape that you find yourself in. I think immediately of a guy called Alan Bean. I could talk for hours about this stuff, but he's a remarkable man, one of the explorers in the book that is still with us, one of the Apollo astronauts.
He was here in town last night, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go. I mean, what a tremendous guy he is. And, you know, he's written an essay for this book describing the joy, the ongoing pleasure that he has in being able to close his eyes and reimagine all of these wonderful things that he has seen in space. And it's sustained him in a whole sort of second career as an artist. Alan Bean, you know, the only artist to have ever painted from direct experience of another planet or moon, if you like. Whereas all of these artists, in a way, were drawing from direct experience from brand new worlds. As I said, sledging or sailing or walking or hiking off the edge of the known world's map. and encountering all manner of wonderful and curious and strange and challenging environments, and hoping to set down these secrets within their journals.
You mention in here that even the smallest notebooks can reveal environments to defy the imagination. Can you tell us about one of those smallest notebooks?
Well, of course. I mean, from a historian's point of view, it's a page that tells us of a particularly fierce blizzard, or the opening of a flower, or the discovery of a small beetle species. Maybe it's Darwin's journal, and we open it at a page with this little ink scribble that looks like a tree, but we understand it to be the first inklings of his theory of evolution through hereditary networks, rather like the lines of a tree, lines drawn together. So the tiniest scribble. I think of someone else, a guy called David Ainley. He's the world's leading penguin biologist. But his annual field trips with just a notebook and a pencil, counting penguins and assessing the health of penguin populations in Antarctica. These kind of simple and ongoing records enable him to extrapolate much larger theories about the health of a whole ecosystem. And despite the rapid technologies, it still comes down to the simple act of observing,
right,
and recording and setting down these things on pencil and paper.
You know, I didn't know this. I just want to begin to wrap up here with your chapter on John James Audubon. You point out that he died worn out and neglected, even though he ranks as one of our most significant naturalist artists. Why did he die worn out and neglected? I didn't know that.
Well, so Audubon, I mean, for those that collect books or those who are keen on bird watching, he's really a giant in the field. He was a keen bird watcher, ornithologist, explorer, naturalist, artist. But he dies worn out because really during his lifetime, at least, his life's work isn't appreciated. He spends the majority of his money trying to print this huge book, The Birds of America, which is now, you know, one of the most sought after and expensive books of all American literature, a huge and quite beautiful, priceless work of art. But during his lifetime, it wasn't thought of as much. And, you know, that's the interesting thing when you dive into explorers' journals. So much changes over the years, and the insights that we can draw from the things inside them, of course, change over the years. Look, it's barely 100 years since the North Pole was seen and described for the very first time. Two competing American explorers, Peary and Cook, in 1908-09. 100 years later, and a bit till today, as we speak, NASA's space probe Juno is orbiting the North Pole of the planet Jupiter. That's almost 600 million kilometers away. And in just 100 years, that technological advance has enabled us to receive images taken from NASA, bounced back to Earth across the black void of space. Quite amazing sketches, digital photographs. Amazing to think, 500 years ago, when 600 years ago, when people are viewing the shorelines of America, perhaps for the first time, or parts of new worlds for the first time, the only means of recording what they're seeing is picking up a paintbrush, sharpening a pencil, and opening up the pages of their journal.
Do you have a sequel in you to this book?
The thing is, you do a book like this and there's always so many people who should have been in it. I'm actually working on a huge atlas of maps, and maybe another book on the art of the sea. But I tell you one figure, if you let me finish with one person who really should have been in the book and isn't. It's very appropriate today, 21st of April. It's John Muir Day, the anniversary of his birth. And for those who don't know the name, he's, you know, seen as the founding father of the conservation movement, an environmentalist, author, writer, a beautiful artist too, a philosopher and a poet. I would have loved to included him in this book. I know he'll be in books of mine in the future. He would write, and I love his writing, and I can bring forth much of it to my mind, but I go out into the wilderness all the time as a polar guide, And I understand his writing, and he was going out into Yosemite in the early American national parks. The mountains are calling, and I must go. In wilderness lies the hope of the world. You know, sentiments like that are, I would hope, sentiments that you could get from looking at this book, Explorer right. Sketchbooks, to learn more about these amazing men and women, but just to remember the simple fact that actually outside your front door, if you're curious enough, there's many wonderful things to see and explore.
That's Hugh Lewis Jones. He's the co-author of Explorer's Sketchbooks, The Art of Discovery and Adventure. He joined us by via Skype from Cornwall, England. And Hugh, what a pleasure. I really enjoyed the book, and I wish you all the best. When you do a second one, come on back on, okay?
I'd love to come to Kansas City. Maybe I'll try and take a trip up the Missouri River sometime. Have a good day, everyone. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this weekend's poetry throwdown here in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters-Baker on how she's handling violence in Kansas City moving forward. We also learned how skilled labor could fix income inequality. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date and also on the NPR One app. On Monday's show, we'll speak with Kansas State lawmakers to review their regular session and find out what we might expect in the May veto session. That's coming up on Monday. Well, this weekend, dozens of writers from all over the country are gathered here in Kansas City for the second annual Kansas City Poetry's Throwdown. And the timing couldn't be better because April is National Poetry Month. Frequent listeners know I love poetry, and poets are almost always just a pleasure to visit with, so no pressure for my present company here. They are Sean Pavey. He's the co-founder of the Main Street Rag Literary Journal, and he's hosted poetry readings in bars, coffee shops, haunted houses, bookstores, libraries, and front porches, as well as seedy motel rooms. And Sean, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
John Dorsey's also here. He makes a living writing and comes to us from out in Bell, Missouri. His work has been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. And John, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Nice to be here, Steve.
Well, Sean, I'm looking at your bio here, and I promise this isn't a job interview, but boy, you sure have done a lot of jobs. What's that all about?
Well, when you graduate with an English degree at the beginning of a recession, you learn to make do.
You got to scramble a little bit.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Did you get inspiration from those jobs? I mean, from that varied history, or is the poetry just an escape for you?
You take inspiration from everything.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's a lot of poems about working third shift in hotels or digging ditches or you know, whatever the situation may have been.
Because you write what you know.
Right. But the problem with writing what you know is that it's an ever-shrinking puddle.
Of stuff that you know.
Right.
Because you already used it up.
Well, yeah. That and the fact that I think some of the best literature and some of the best poetry comes from when we're telling bold-faced lies.
Oh, really?
Writing what you know, I mean, you only know so much. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other things to play with.
You know, John, you make a living as a writer, as I mentioned, out in Bell, Missouri. Where is Bell?
Bell is about 2 hours from St. Louis. Don't ask me what direction, because I have never driven a car in my life, so I could not tell you.
How do you get around? How did you get here today?
My friend Matthew drove me here today from Bell.
So you have good friends who hang with you.
I do have good friends.
Yeah. You're not just doing poems, right? As I understand, you've got a screenplay that's being turned into a film?
Yes. I wrote a screenplay for Paladin Night Pictures, which is based in New Jersey. It's called Missouri Loves Company, and it actually starts shooting on June 9th. And it's going to be shot in New York, New Jersey, and in Bell, Missouri.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
What's it about?
Time. Basically, Steve, you know, we get those spam emails where they're from someone in Togo or the Congo, and they're offering us $5 million.
Yeah.
We just give them our personal information. This is about a guy who drunkenly gives the person his personal information, and they drain his bank account. So in order to get his money back, he has to go to a small town in the middle of nowhere, Missouri.
That's great. That's a great premise. What other kinds of writing do you do?
I've spent the last 15 years off and on as a newspaper journalist as well. I worked for a long
Sorry, you're speaking to a journalist here. Yeah.
Yeah. I worked for the Toledo Free Press for a lot of years. Worked for a number of papers. I focused on a lot of celebrity interviews. I've interviewed like Ted Nugent, Keanu Reeves, Ricky Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Why poetry for you? I mean, where did that come from?
I've been writing poetry since I was 12 or 13 years old, but I've been involved in the publishing of poetry since I was 15. I'm on my 50th book now. But as
it's a tough racket, though.
Yeah, I've since 1995. I had my first book in 1995, and since then I've done 50. But Gregory Corso was a family friend, and if anyone doesn't know him, he wrote the book Gasoline.
Yeah.
And he brought me into all this, so he either cursed me or gave me life, and I'm not sure which.
Sean, why poetry for you? I mean, of all the things in the world.
Well, it's I had a moment in high school where I could have either chosen to study classical oboe at Oberlin or creative writing at Carolina. And I figured that poets would have better luck with the ladies than classical oboes.
Than an oboist,
yes.
Eh?
So
were you right? So,
no.
No. Not even close.
No.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. I chose the much more lucrative path of poetry, which is why I don't do it for a living.
It's time to go back to the oboe.
Yeah. John, paint us a picture here of what it's like reading your poems up in front of a bunch of people. I mean, do you still get nervous even after 50 books?
You know, leading up to the reading, yes, I get nervous. I'll probably pee like 15 times. But once I start reading, no. Because I just imagine that I'm the only one in the room. And that's kind of how it works for me. And I've read for three people, and I've read actually for like 2,000 people. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, what gets you inspired to actually sit down and start writing poetry?
You know, that's changed over the years. I used to write a lot of abstraction, but now I write a lot of personal narrative. So really, Bell, Missouri, the town where I'm from, it has some of the most interesting people you've ever met. And it's those people that get me inspired to write poems. And I always refer to it as the Twin Peaks of Missouri, and I think it is.
In what way? Tell us about some of those people.
One of my neighbors down the street who lives about a mile away, he's a former alligator wrestler from Florida.
Oh, really? There's fodder there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just that sort of guy. And he's really gruff and really rough. But then, you know, I go over his house, and his wife is confined to a wheelchair. And the story of their marriage is one of the sweetest things I've ever seen. And you wouldn't expect that from a guy like this. And it's stuff like that that keeps me writing.
Sean, what keeps you writing? Alligator wrestlers down the street or not?
Well, yeah. Well, I haven't run into any alligator wrestlers lately, but I do occasionally run into, you know, people around my neighborhood walking aimlessly, which is kind of strange in the suburbs.
And you're from where?
I live in Mission.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know that any one particular thing inspires me. What I like to do is find a couple of sort of disconnected things and then find that tenuous thread of connection to them to tie them together. Mm-hmm. And into some sort of narrative about the universal experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, one thing we understand that got you inspired is a friend of your mom's who got in a little trouble for stalking the musician Phil Collins, right?
That is correct.
Is that true?
That is the true story.
What happened there?
I guess she told us perpetually that she and Phil Collins were exchanging love letters, that they had a thing going on. And so she ends up going to a Phil Collins concert, and I guess she tries to, like, jump a fence or whatever to get to Phil.
This is your mother.
No, this is my mother's best friend.
Your mother's best friend.
My mother's best friend. And so she winds up getting taken by security, and she gets arrested for stalking Phil. But it was just a running joke in our house that because she was like, Phil and I are exchanging love letters, and I have a poem about that.
I was going to say, your poem is titled Dear Phil. Would you read it to us here?
I will.
Yeah.
I will.
All right. This is John Dorsey reading from his poem, Dear Phil.
When I was a kid, My mother's best friend got arrested for stalking Phil Collins. She would follow him around the country like the Grateful Dead. She talked about how they exchanged mad, passionate love letters and how they were going to run away to their own private island in Florida. Phil was a great lover of sunshine and wrestling lyrics like the alligators of summer. He just couldn't let his female fans know that his songs were all about her. They'd stop buying his records. We just nodded when she told us that we didn't understand how the business worked. The last time she called was right after Hurricane Andrew. By then, she had left her husband and was living in Florida. Phil would be joining her soon. She had written him just last week. He was a great lover, a real giver, and his fingers ran through her hair like sunshine beaming through the clouds.
That's great. Phil Collins, no less.
Yes.
Did she ever see that poem?
No, she has not, and she probably won't. My original intention before I wrote the poem was to write a whole book of their fictional love letters between the two of them, and I still might.
Well, I mean, that poem is funny. There's also a little sadness attached to it.
There is. And I think there's, I write a lot about people, and I think there's a little bit of sadness in a lot of the people I write about.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Sean, this weekend's event is called a throwdown. So I got to ask, is it a competition?
It is not a competition. This is a bunch of poets gathering together out of a love of the art and an appreciation for each other's work.
Do you tend to know each other?
We have, over the last couple of years, have been kind of building a network. It started with a network between Kansas City Poets and St. Louis, then Cleveland, then Pittsburgh, then New York, and this thing just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
I should point out that Kansas City's Poetry Throwdown is going on today, tomorrow, and Sunday at Prospero's Bookstore. That's at 1800 West 39th Street. More information, go to SpartanPressKC.com/throwdown or just show up at Prospero's Bookstore over there on 39th Street. So what do poets talk about when y'all get together?
Whiskey.
Probably.
Right.
Yeah.
We talk about what's happening in each other's towns. How can we get a bunch of people from Cleveland, for instance, to Kansas City or to Dallas?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has arisen out of these interactions is an awareness of a real interest in poetry around the country and little pockets of really grassroots activity.
Mm-hmm.
If we can start networking that together and figuring out ways to get people on the road and make that, funding that travel and lodging and find a way to make that sustainable. That's kind of our ultimate goal with all of this.
You know, John, I always wonder why poetry doesn't take off more than it has. What's holding it back?
I don't know what's holding it back. Well, I do. The perception of poetry, I think that we have a perception of poetry that is probably 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that all poetry rhymes, that all poetry is boring. To be honest, I read poetry going back like 1,000 years. But if a lot of the stuff that people perceive as boring, I think of as boring, too. So I can tell you that I'm doing my best as an artist to make poetry as entertaining as possible. And I think a lot of people at the Kansas City Throwdown would say the same.
Mm-hmm. You feel that way, too?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think our greatest mission as purveyors of an art form is to breathe some life back into it.
Yeah, yeah. Because you say so much so economically, so quickly, and so powerfully. I'm always wondering, then, why isn't that more attractive to people in this age when people have short attention spans anyway? You think poetry would be right down their pikes, you know?
You would think so. I believe I talked about this all the time, like an accessibility of language. If I can't understand it, then you didn't succeed in your poem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly, yeah. Sean, do you bring something with you you wanted to read too?
I did.
Yeah, what do you have there?
Well, this is, if I had a greatest hit, it would be this. This is the first poem I ever had published. It's in my first book,
really?
Talking to Shadows.
And it was the one that hit maybe better than the others.
Right. There's a reason why I think it's popular. It's entitled At the Waffle House. And as all Waffle House poems should, it starts with an epigram from 1 Corinthians 15:51. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Out of beer and out of time. Last call puts Tyler and I in a place where mysterious blendings of caffeine and nicotine work our domestic beer-dulled brains awake, where redneck jukeboxes full of whiskey voices lament great losses of the true ones and how we can all get stomped flatter than lonely Texas highways complete with tumbleweeds and dust devils simply by love. So where are the rest of those Hank Williams poets whose tears fall to the ground like rain, making puddles only bleary-eyed drunks drinking their way through their blues can see? When thy cup is empty, it shall be filled. When she gets around to it and isn't bellowing side orders of bacon with those hash browns. So go ye then on down to a place where things somehow come to short order in those small hours before dawn, through fogs of conversation rambling through coffee steam and cigarettes piling dead in testament to a new faith, healing busted hearts in confirmation that you will never be the same.
That's Sean Pavey, co-founder of the Main Street Rag Literary Journal, reading from his own poetry. He's taking part in this weekend's Kansas City Poetry Throwdown, going on today through Sunday at Prospero's Bookstore. That's over there on 39th Street, 1800 West 39th Street. Sean, what's the poetry scene like here in Kansas City? Is there much of one? What do you see out there?
Well, I think there's a very active poetry scene in Kansas City. I think the greatest challenge we have is that it's very siloed in its communities. There's kind of a performance slam community. Mm-hmm. There's your more academic group of writers. There are what we like to call the West 39 school, which is straddles somewhere between that. Mm-hmm. And
Prospero's is kind of a hub for a lot of this, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is. Always has been, I think, since their inception.
Sort of what they're about, encouraging some of this.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
Will Latham, yeah.
You know, not only is Prospero's a bookstore, it's kind of an unofficial community gathering place. Mm-hmm. And the Volcker neighborhood city hall, in a way. But yes, there's a lot of stuff going on in Kansas City. And I think in all of our communities, our challenge is to find ways to interact and to find ways to collaborate so that we can let people know that Kansas City is a writing town. Mm-hmm. and that there's amazing writing happening here.
John, how is Kansas City viewed from across the state?
I'll tell you, from across the state and across the country, because I've traveled all over, that it's viewed very positively as a large, large community, one of the mm-hmm. larger in the United States.
And how many poets are you guys expecting this weekend?
About 47.
47?
Yeah, and that's in terms of who will read. Now, actual attendance, I expect a few hundred people will probably show up. And I want to say, too, that this year marks the 20th anniversary of Prospero's.
Hmm. Is it Prospero's or how do you guys say it?
I've always said Prospero's.
Yeah, that's what I used to say, too, and I was told, nah, that's not how you say it.
Well,
that's,
then we're wrong.
Yeah, well, then, no, then maybe
we're
you're right.
We're all wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what should people know who want to attend one of these things? What as you walk in the door, what should you expect?
There's going to be a lot of people. It's going to be a rowdy crowd.
Is it upstairs in the bookstore?
It's upstairs in the bookstore. Yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun. We do have events on Saturday at the Writer's Place. We're starting
I was going to mention that. Yeah. The Writer's Place on Saturdays, beginning at 9 o'clock in the morning, which will include publishers and poets, and it's open to the public, too.
Right. So we're having a publisher's talk in the morning and readings in the afternoon, and then we'll continue the readings again tomorrow
night. And publishers are what, looking for new poets, good stuff to publish?
Right.
Are they seeing a market there? Are they pursuing this actively?
Absolutely. That's why they're coming here, is to network with new talent. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons behind this this talk is to expose poets to the right and wrong ways of getting your stuff in print. Mm-hmm. There are it's a challenge, having been on the staff of a national literary magazine. You know, there's a lot of stuff you don't ever want to read again. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to hear what to stay away from.
And when it comes to the right way to get something published, just real quickly, the right way is what?
It always helps to know the market. Mm-hmm. You know, don't send your profanity-laden poems to kind of the garden club poetry magazine.
Yeah,
you
not,
know,
not a good idea.
Right. Yeah. Know your market. Make sure you've read the journal that you're submitting to and understand their style before sending them something that doesn't fit.
Kansas City's Poetry Throwdown is going on today, tomorrow, and Sunday at Prospero's Bookstore at 1800 West 39th Street. I want to thank Sean Pavey, who's the co-founder of the Main Street Rag Literary Journal, and John Dorsey, who makes a living writing and comes to us from out in Bell, Missouri. Gentlemen, thanks very much, and good luck this weekend. Okay, guys?
Thanks, Steve.
You bet.
It's an honor.
You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's show, I'm joined by Kansas State legislators, and we'll hear what issues they'll be tackling in the May veto session. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Suzanne Hogan, Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all, and you are up to date. Thank you.